Good morning, Steve Dale on WGN Radio. After doing some of the interviews I've done over the past month or two, having to do with training methods, and this book came across my desk, I said, I need to talk to this lady. This lady is Dawn Antoniak, and the name of the book is Empowerment Training for Your Power Dog. And, well, it'll become evident, Dawn, to my audience as to why I said, I need to talk to you, because because of what this book really is about and what you're saying, which is greatly based on science. So first off, I'll let you explain, because you can do it far better than me, in general, what this book is about.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for inviting me here to talk with your audience. This book was written to help people understand what it means to bring what I call a power dog into their home. And my loose definition of power dogs are the big dogs, the strong dogs, dogs that have an ancestry that's based in, say, hunting big game, or in some cases fighting other animals or protecting property against people. You know, these dogs are beautiful, wonderful animals, but they come with a rather unique history, breed history, and also a unique set of demands in order to be able to live in our homes successfully as part of our family. And so what I wanted to do is really, like you said, you know, provide information to people that are considering or already have one of these power dogs in their homes, information how to appreciate the animals and then how to incorporate them in a positive way into their family and teach them the things that they need to know to be able to be a welcomed part of the family that, you know, can be enjoyable for everyone and really bring forth the things that people want to have in a good companion animal.
Well, I don't know if you know an ethologist named Kim Brophy, and who's just absolutely brilliant. And I had not met her before. We were both speaking at a conference in Mexico City. And I did my talk, and then I'm unplugging my computer and all that, and she's plugging in. And I said, oh, so nice to meet you. And she said, you're going to hate my talk. I said, what? She said, you're just going to hate it. Because you're the guy out there saying that a dog is a dog is a dog as you fight breed bans, communities. Not so much anymore, because communities understand these breed bans don't do a thing. But back in the day, communities didn't know that. And they said, we're going to ban pit bulls or dogs that look like pit bulls and often other breeds as well. And I would fight those bans. And one of my lines was, and still is, a dog is a dog is a dog. Well, her talk, which is absolutely correct, is saying that, yes, they are all dogs, but if you have thousands of years of breeding behind that dog, there is no way, physically, but also what they were bred for, that a husky is going to have likely the same temperament as a mastiff because of what they were bred for example. And I watched her talk and I said, you're brilliant. So now we have a talk that we do together, actually, because we bring out sort of the best of both sides of this issue. So I tell that long story because I want you to talk about, and you write about this in your book, that no, you're not getting a little toy poodle here if you are getting one of these what you call power breeds.
Exactly. And there's truth on both sides, as you said. A dog is a dog is a dog in the sense that the concepts, the approaches that we can use successfully to train, for example, a Chihuahua, we can also use those methodologies with some adaptations for a Cane Corso. You know, their brain works the same, and they are dogs. They're not humans. So in that sense, yeah, all dogs are alike. But every breed that we have, or if you have a mix, you still have a mix at some point of, you know, some breeds or types of dogs, they were bred for a purpose. You know, us having dogs just as pets, that's a Victorian concept. You know, we, you know, historically as humans have been breeding these dogs to do certain things. We brought out certain natural instincts in some breeds and suppressed others so that those dogs could do work or perform a function for us. So with a lot of these power dogs, that function came, or that function that they were developed to serve, related to protection or helping against very large animals, whereas, you know, your retriever breeds, the instincts that were brought out had to do with, oh, I'm going to willingly take this thing that I could eat, and I'm going to bring it back to you and say, here, person, you know, we finesse that genetic code and those instincts to get what we have. And in order to really appreciate any dog that you have in your home, you have to give a nod to that history. Yes, they're individuals. Yes, you know, they're going to have their unique traits. But at the end of the day, for example, I'm looking at my Dalmatian laying here, you know, listening to me. You know, no matter how unique she is, she still has somewhere buried in there the instincts and traits that Dalmatians were bred for over the years. And
absolutely,
if we ignore that, we're in trouble.
All right.
We've dug a hole that it'll be hard to get out of.
And I agree with everything you said. So the point that I most agree with is the intent of your book, in addition to what you just said, is that training a dog that is a so-called power dog, you don't have to be dominant over the dog. You don't have to show any physical ability that us humans are stronger than you, and I've got to show you that when you're a puppy, so I'm going to roll you over to prove that point. I mean, there are trainers that encourage this still, and you're saying no. That is not only inappropriate, it's actually not effective. And in fact, the response back could mean ultimately that that dog needs to be relinquished because you've created a problem.
Oh, yeah. And the poor dog is the one that suffers. And then let's take this one step further with some of the power breeds. Some of these breeds were bred to, actually, unfortunately, some of them were bred to hunt people. Bred to fight animals. You know, you've got all these instincts that are buried at, like I said, at some level. Sometimes it's at the surface, sometimes it's very deep. But, you know, if you go heaping on this unnecessary, inappropriate, you know, inhumane type of training methodology on these dogs, you're actually bringing out the very thing you think you're trying to suppress.
Exactly.
You know, let's inflict pain on a breed that's, you know, used in the baiting rings historically. Yeah, they're just going to say, bring it on in spades, you know. It's absolutely backwards, unnecessary, unsafe, and in my opinion, inhumane to do that. When we have so much knowledge, so many techniques that are so much, you know, first of all, easier, because let's face it, we all like easy, right? Easy, more humane, more effective, and frankly, I think a lot more fun for both the dog as a learner and the human as the teacher to use. We can accomplish so much with these guys, but you have to take a step back. You have to be willing to put in some work and not look for that quick, superficial fix. And, you know, and really get to know your dog, because if you don't know your dog as a breed and as an individual, you know, that's going to make any training a little more difficult than it needs to be. So appreciate your dog, get to know your dog, and boy, these other techniques just make so much more sense, become so much easier, it becomes a lifestyle, and before you know it, you've got the pity, you've got the Great Dane, you've got the dog that everybody else wishes they had.
Don Antoniak is here. Empowerment training for your power dog. You said these techniques, when we come back on WGN, we'll find out what these techniques are, exactly what you should be doing. And also coming up, an interview with Dr. Susan Little about overweight and obese cats, and that's a problem on WGN. Don Antoniak, empowerment training for your power dog. By power dogs, we're meaning dogs that are generally very large dogs, dogs that would fall into the category of maybe you'd be calling them guard dogs. We're talking about pit bull type dogs. So for these dogs, we're talking about what not to do, but let's talk about what to do How do you train these dogs? I assume, well, I cheated. I looked at the book. So I know the answer in great part is positive reinforcement. But how do you know that's the right way to do this, Dawn?
Well, science tells us it's the right way to do it. There's been plenty of studies out there that, you know, show the effectiveness of basically rewarding a dog, giving a dog something it wants and to increase the likelihood that a particular behavior is going to happen again in the future. So, you know, most people think of that as cookie training. You know, we've got the science to back us up, and we also have the practical. You know, people have been using these techniques successfully across the breed for years and years and years. And it's an intuitive kind of thing, too. When you break it down, dogs do behaviors that get them what they want. If doing a particular behavior gets them something that they really want, a cookie, a pat on the head, whatever, they're more likely to do that same behavior again in the future. So, you know, using these techniques, you don't have to get into this fake struggle, power struggle with the dog at all. You know, you're encouraging the dog to do things to earn the things that it wants from you. And it's very easy to do, but it does, again, involve knowing your dog.
Very quickly, we're running out of time. So does this mean, as some trainers, many trainers out there still say, okay, you have one of these dogs that you're calling a power dog, you have to very quickly get control, slap an electronic collar, an e-collar on these dogs, or a shock collar, all one and the same. Do you need to do that?
Absolutely not.
And by doing that, what are you, in fact, doing?
Well, first of all, you're inflicting pain. You know, because if it alters the dog's behavior at all, it has to be uncomfortable to the dog, regardless if you call it a tingle collar, oh, it doesn't hurt your dog. You know, if it doesn't cause your dog any discomfort, it's not going to change your dog's behavior. So number one, you're hurting your dog. Number two, you're playing into those instincts. These are breeds that were bred to ignore things like pain, to learn to work through pain and continue their behaviors. So you're actually running the risk of strengthening the very behaviors you're trying to get rid of. And you're also just you're putting a Band-Aid over the issue. You may get a dog to appear to learn how to behave, but the truth is they're just acting in the moment to avoid the discomfort. You haven't taught them what you do want them to learn to do,
and
you do want them to behave.
And that last sentence, by the way, is what dog trainers do. That's the trick they use when they show, look, I made the difference. But the dog, you can get a dog at the moment to appease, to not want to feel pain. I mean, we would do the same thing. But that dog, that behavior hasn't been taught and probably will reoccur, maybe even more so than it did before. Dawn Antoniak, it's an important read if you're getting one of these power dogs, as you call them, one of the larger dogs, or a pit bull type dog. You write very well about what you don't need to do and what you should be doing. Empowerment training for your power dog. Thank you so much, Dawn.
Thank you, Steve.
Dr. Susan Little is a cat veterinarian who travels all around the world talking about cats. In addition to that, past president of the American Association of Feline Practitioners, past president of the Wynn Feline Foundation, past president of all cats on the planet.
Mm.
Dr. Susan Little, it's always good to talk to you. And maybe not all over the planet, but certainly in America, most cats tend to be overweight or obese. Statistically, what is it, 60%,
I think. It's up there.
Here's what happens when I speak, and you tell me if you have the same experience. You say what the data is, which I think for cats is, in fact, 60%, at least for indoor cats. And then I ask the veterinarians in the room or technicians, is that about right? And 90% of the time, most people raise their hands and say, no, it's more like 70%.
Yeah, seriously. It's a growing epidemic, no pun intended.
So to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes people, despite
the fact that you suggest otherwise and I suggest otherwise, we'll put cats on a crash diet.
Mm.
And probably that isn't good for humans. I know that's not good for dogs, but it's downright dangerous for cats.
Cats are so unique, right? So their nutrition needs are so different from ours and so different from dogs. Cats need protein every day or bad things happen. They really are carnivores. So if we put them on a crash diet, or even if we change them to a food that they don't like and they stop eating and you try to wait it out, you know, this is a little passive aggressive thing going on here. I'm going to wait you out.
Or if it's an older cat who, for a variety of medical reasons, is not eating.
Absolutely. Anything that stops an overweight or obese cat from eating may put them rapidly into a state where they don't have enough protein. They don't have enough calories. But what do they have? They have fat and they have muscle. So they can get energy from their body fat and they can get their protein by breaking down their own muscle. And that can put them into a life-threatening situation.
Which is called sometimes fatty liver disease.
Fatty liver disease, yeah. And, you know, people get fatty liver disease too, but they don't tend to get as critically ill with it as cats do. And it's just what it sounds like. The liver accumulates fat as well as the rest of the body. Sort of the scientific name is hepatic, which means liver, mm-hmm. and then lipidosis, which means fat, so fatty liver disease.
So what is a sign that that might be happening to your cat?
And it happens fairly quickly if cats go dramatically off their food. And again, this is a disease we see in overweight and obese cats, not in normal size cats.
And I didn't let you answer yet, but I want to point out, I ask because people always don't know that their cat is, or if you have three cats and they're feeding from a communal dish, or they free feed, they eat whenever they want, you may not know that this one cat for 2 or 3 days in a row hasn't eaten.
Yeah, it's often harder for owners to know if a cat has decreased its food intake, just of the things you mentioned, the way we feed cats.
Mm-hmm.
So once they reach that point where they start getting sick, first they'll often get jaundiced. So if you're kind of observant owner, you spend some time petting your cat, you might start to notice that maybe the whites of the eyes are looking a little yellowy, or if the cat is white-coated, you'll see some yellow tinge. And they lose weight quickly, and as the disease progresses, they start vomiting, they get lethargic. So they're obviously sick by the time they kind of tip over, the cliff edge, right?
Is this an emergency veterinarian situation?
Yeah, it's a get to your vet fast, because these cats can, once they start that decline, it can go very, very fast. So we do need life-saving measures.
How do you avoid it? I guess the answer to this is make sure your cat is eating just about every day.
Yeah. I mean, it's a simple answer, right? So when we have a very fat cat and we need to change its diet, maybe to lose weight or for whatever reason, mm-hmm. we do it carefully because we don't want them to stop eating.
And in addition to that, it's not only the scenario you describe, but sometimes older cats who, just because older cats do this very often, sometimes because of a change of diet, but sometimes just because, they don't eat as regularly. Mm. So is it important that we really keep an eye on what those cats are eating or not eating, just to make sure they are eating?
Yeah, and that's true not just for fatty liver disease, but almost any disease cats get. Sometimes the first sign is that decline in appetite.
Mm-hmm. And also with the decline in appetite, again, I'm talking about older cats, they can lose muscle mass.
They lose it easily and fast.
Uh-huh. And it turns out that's a really important thing.
It is important because it's a marker that their nutrition status isn't good. They might have a severe disease. And then once we identify the problem and start to correct it, it's harder to correct. You know, it's easier to lose muscle than it is to gain muscle once you got into that situation.
Really? Interesting.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard to put it back.
So what do you suggest that people do?
So pay close attention to your cat. Make sure it's eating every day. Anything that doesn't look right to you, make sure you pat your cat every day so you know you get your hands on your cat. Always, it's better. Veterinarian would rather you come in and us to say, don't worry, it's okay, than you to wait too long.
Excellent.
We always rather you check with us.
All right. She is Dr. Susan Little, the lady with all the answers.
Some answers.
Well, when it comes to cats, maybe not life. Dr. Susan Little, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So the good news is cats are living longer. So are dogs. So are most of our pets, really. And in fact, in a couple of weeks, we'll have Dr. Dana Varble on the show, and she'll be talking about other pets. It's that time of year, you know, and there's old research out there that suggest, and it's old, it's not right, that suggest never get a pet for the family around the holidays. Well, that's been debunked. That's actually a myth, that people are more likely to give up their pets because they made a spontaneous decision for getting the kids a pet for Christmas. Well, a shelter or anywhere you get that animal from, hopefully they're asking you questions, whether it's June or December that you're getting a pet, and they're asking you if you really want to make that commitment. And if you get the pet, if it's a hamster or gerbil or whatever it might be from a pet store, hopefully you are considering the long-term care of that pet. And that's what we'll talk about with Dr. Varbal and what pet might be right. If you don't want a dog or a cat, hamster, is that a good idea? Guinea pig, is that a good idea? Anyway, that's in a couple of weeks. What I really wanted to talk about now I'm running out of time, is cats and kidney disease. It's a real issue. If you have a cat and your cat is 5 years of age or older, talk to your veterinarian about a couple of new amazing tests available. One is called Renal Tech. The other is SDMA, which is an acronym for something really, really long. You don't need to know that. What you need to know is that there is now new technology that can help predict kidney disease much earlier than we were ever able to do so before. We'll talk to you next time. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN.